In 2010, as part of a project helping small Midwestern towns create public murals, artist Dave Lowenstein was all set up to go to Joplin, Missouri. But shortly before he was supposed to head into town, a tornado hit. It was the big one, the Joplin tornado. The town was nearly destroyed, which filled Dave's mind with questions and doubts. Not only how to paint a mural when so many buildings weren't even standing, but whether to paint a mural, whether it even mattered anymore. So he went to Joplin and he asked, "Does this still matter?" The resounding answer he got was yes, more than ever. So Dave got to work. Here he is in a documentary about the project, working with his collaborators, kids, who had experienced the storm.
Do you think tigers dream?
Yes.
Yeah. Do you think frogs dream?
Yeah.
Do you think plants dream?
No.
So here's what I'm thinking about. What if all of the tigers and all of the frogs and all of the plants and all of the people and all of the other animals and buildings and bicycles here in Joplin had a dream together? Okay. What would that dream be if it was dreaming about how it wanted to be in the future? What would the dream of Joplin be?
He said to be fixed. That is so gut-wrenching. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And today, we're going to meet the artist behind that project and so many others like it, Dave Lowenstein. He's the subject of our portrait session. Hi, Dave.
Hello, Gina.
What is it like to hear that clip, like 7 years later now, I guess, 6 years later, and especially now that you're about to become a father? I wonder if you hear it differently.
Yeah, instantly I get emotional hearing that. It brings back a lot of memories of that time. We were working with kids, I think it was from the Boys and Girls Club in Joplin. So it was this summer program that was overwhelmed because so many young people had been displaced after the storm. And making drawings, but really not knowing how many of these kids had been directly impacted. Some of them had lost their homes. Others had lost loved ones, and it was an incredibly sensitive and heightened moment to be making art.
You know, you ask them really carefully, it seems, to paint their dreams or to draw their dreams rather than to draw the storm.
Right. That was a really conscious choice. And it had to do with the overall project. The mural project wasn't ever intended to be about the storm. We had started actually before the storm came. So it made sense to ask a broader question that would allow kids to fill those sheets of paper with their own ideas. And what was really interesting and tragic in some sense was that many of them did draw about the storm and their own personal experience in it. Some of them, you know, showing the destruction and loss. Others, though, showing folks coming to help and rebuilding.
What had you imagined that this mural was going to do or be about before the storm hit?
Well, you know, you never really know. I mean, it's one of the wonderful things about this work is that pretty much going with a blank slate. You know, you do some research about the place. You maybe know a few people from there, but I'd never spend any significant amount of time there. I know that folks with the Chamber of Commerce wanted it to be about Route 66. We were already thinking, how can we steer away from that?
Why did you want to steer away from it?
Because it was a cliche, and there are lots of murals about Route 66, and we knew that Joplin had, as most communities do, many other stories that had yet been told.
You know, it seemed like, if I remember from the documentary called Called to Walls, it seemed like the city officials really wanted it to be, I think the term they used was flypaper, attracting people to the town. I mean, it was supposed to be an engine of promotion. And you as an artist, I mean, artists generally kind of don't want to be necessarily just vehicles of promotion. There's some deeper message or story that you want to tell for its own sake. Is that a tension that you encounter a lot?
Yeah, especially with public art, I think, and especially these days. There's a renewed interest in public art all across the country and other places as well to sort of leverage the vibrancy, that's one of the key words these days, that public art can bring to bring folks to restaurants and maybe to buy condos and so on. And I think in Joplin, they had a similar notion. They wanted folks to come downtown and shop and enjoy restaurants and so on, which is a perfectly good reason to do a mural, but it's not really where my heart is.
Yeah, I mean, you ended up in the middle of kind of a contentious situation where there were people, you know, the community really rallied around sort of reluctantly the idea of depicting the storm or dealing with the storm in some way, even though a lot of people really didn't want to be reminded of that. It sort of became clear that was just going to keep coming up. How did you work your way through that?
Well, we worked our way through that. You know, I'm sort of I'm a participant, but I'm also a facilitator and teacher and partner in the project. And, you know, initially we didn't know each other. And I think it took some time before this group of people we were working with developed a sense of trust with each other and could share some of the stories of their experience. And as we did, it became more and more evident that not only sharing their experience of what happened, but what they looked forward to in the rebuilding of their community was essential to depict in the mural.
You know, a lot of people might be surprised that as a muralist who's brought into towns, I mean, not just right around here, but really like in other countries, you're this visiting artist, you know, some people might think of that as like the hotshot who comes in and paints a wall and has their glory displayed for all to see. People might be surprised to hear you continually saying we and talking about what the town wants. Can you describe your process?
Yeah, so I see myself as part of a long tradition of muralists really coming out of the civil rights movement. There was a group of artists in Chicago. I grew up on the north side of Chicago. In the late 1960s, who decided that they were going to create murals not to celebrate famous people or well-known events, but to celebrate their own stories that hadn't been told yet. And they were done not only by professional artists, but by neighborhood residents, by shopkeepers, and so on. And this is a tradition that's developed since then, the late 60s. There are not a lot of artists who sort of take on this process, but I'm really grateful to have mentors from that time that have inspired me.
What is the process?
So, yeah, the process is basically a lead artist, a design team of people who choose themselves, and they can be of any age, of any skill level.
Self-nominating.
Self-nominating, absolutely. So we're not choosing the most proficient artists or the most popular people or the most significant people in a community. These are people who want to do it and have a story to tell. And they drive the research, the design, and the execution of the mural with sort of my conducting, you know, or choreographing.
How do you communicate even that you're looking for these people and their stories? I mean, I think like it's hard enough to understand a process once you've seen the end result. They haven't seen what it is you're talking about yet.
Yeah, it depends where you work. You know, in some places I work, doing projects like this is more commonplace. They've done something like it in the past. But a lot of the places I work, you're right. It's the first time their community's engaged in a public project like this. So we do a lot of work up front, you know, visiting, talking with folks, not even actually committing to doing the project until there's real backing from local folks. So presentations, visiting with folks at coffee shops and at churches and at schools to build that awareness before we get started.
Can you give an example of someone who has self-nominated to be involved in a mural and who has just really surprised you or touched you with their story?
Wow, there's so many. I'm thinking right now, I just finished a project in Lawrence. It's a really interesting project because it was a reimagination of a mural that was destroyed a few years ago called The Pollinators. And one of the people that came to the design team is a young woman named Janata Birdling. She's just finishing high school. She's going to go to KU. And when she first sort of suggested that she was interested, she had worked on a mural in the housing development that she lives in and wanted to take the next step with some encouragement from family. She was incredibly shy, not really wanting to share her opinion about issues of the day and so on. But by building this team, many of the folks who shared common interests, she really sort of came out of, I wouldn't call it a shell, but found her voice in the project and became a real leader by the end, by the time we were done. And I think she hopes to go on and do more murals herself.
I wanted to talk to you about pollinators. As you said, that it's both a new project and an old project. It was a mural originally created a few years back, kind of facing the farmer's market on New Hampshire, right?
Right.
And it depicted famous African-Americans from Kansas's history, people who had come from the state and gone on to do great things either there or elsewhere. And the building ended up being sold and then demolished. There was a big hubbub about it, and then now there's this reimagining. Can you first of all tell us about the original project and why you were doing it, how you did it?
Yeah, really fascinating project. So this stems from the fact that the artist Aaron Douglas, the leading artist of the Harlem Renaissance, so you think of the leading poet perhaps being Langston Hughes, also from Kansas to a certain degree. Well, his counterpart as a visual artist was Aaron Douglas, born and raised in Topeka, a huge influence on my own work. I've followed his work for as long as I can remember and has influenced me a lot. The Spencer Museum was doing a retrospective on Aaron Douglas, which was amazing because so many people in the area didn't know about his work. And as part of it, they invited me to think about doing a community-based mural that celebrated his vision. So that's how we got started. But as these projects do, when we got the design team together, folks said, well, Aaron Douglas, that's great. But who were the other artists from that time, African-American artists with roots in Kansas that also contributed in some really significant way? And we did research, and it wasn't hard to find many who did, and those became the subjects of the mural.
What can you talk about the feelings that emerged when people found out that this mural was in jeopardy? Because I remember at that time, just people felt very strongly about it. I guess in part because, like you said, there's huge community involvement around these projects. So people had contributed as children.
Yeah, well, this is a particularly meaningful mural, I think, because of participation, like you said, also because of its location. It's at Lawrence Farmers Market, which is, you know, really well attended. Many hundreds of people go every weekend, but also because of the subject. This was a subject, you know, we called them pollinators. This group of seven artists, putting them together in one image had never really been done before, considering them as a group. And then also connecting their contributions to this notion of pollination, that they, like hummingbirds and butterflies, got their start in one place, but then flew off to New York and Paris and Los Angeles and pollinated elsewhere. It was really a compelling idea for folks in Lawrence, and I think they had never considered that it would go away.
So how did that end up resolving itself?
Yeah, so there was, we knew for a while before it came down that it was going to come down, and there were all sorts of considerations. Can it be saved where it is? Can it be rebuilt somewhere else? And so on. And these were conversations with the new developer, with the Spencer Museum, with the city, and with many, many residents. And we actually came together as a group and cooperatively found a solution, which was to recreate it on the new building.
So is it going to be a straight-on recreation, or is this... The word that I keep seeing in news reports is reimagined.
Right. Well, it's finished.
Oh.
Yeah, just finished a few weeks ago.
I'm sorry. I have not been to Lawrence in a little while.
Right. So I encourage everyone to go and take a look. It is not a straight-on recreation. It is reimagined in many ways. I'll give you a clue. All of the original figures exist in the new mural as well, but they have changed what they're doing. They're responding in a way to what's happened over the time that the mural came down.
You have worked on murals, as I've mentioned, both around here and in other countries. And I'm curious about whether working on a mural in another country, you know, as you go from place to place, is it different? Are the expectations different? Is the experience in some crucial way, like, just totally not happening through the same lens?
Well, I don't have that many experiences working. I've worked in Northern Ireland and South Korea and in Brazil out of the U.S., and they are quite different, each of them, in the way folks approach these projects. In Northern Ireland, for example, there were lots and lots of murals all around, but they were very different kind of murals. They were politically charged murals having to do with this long, long struggle between the unionists and the nationalists and so on. So doing a community-type mural was sort of treading carefully into an area that could be politicized very quickly. While in Brazil, I worked in three cities, so I'll sort of generalize here. Folks there is art on the street everywhere, and people were super comfortable, you know, from kids to adults to participating in a way that I don't see as often here.
How did you experience that?
Yeah, so Brazil was like coming home to my people in a way, because there was such a easy...
Just in the relationship with art?
Yeah, with the relationship with art. You know, I was working with artists as well as just residents, but, you know, we spoke the same language, although we didn't. I was trying to learn Portuguese at the time. It was also lovely to be creating a mural amidst many other murals. Very often I'm working in a situation where, you know, we're doing the first and only mural in a community, and the burden of that can be, you know, really heavy. But in a community where there are many, many stories told all over the neighborhood, yours is just a part of it.
Talk to me about the burden.
Yeah. So, you know, especially in the murals that are depicted in the film called The Walls, a lot of those places were doing one of the first large public art pieces in the town. And the expectation for a lot of people is everything has to go in it, you know? And folks,
everything that matters.
Everything that matters. And the people who have more privilege and power, well, they think their vote counts twice as much. And we have to negotiate all of those issues while at the same time saying we can't. We can't put everything in it. This is one, you know, one iteration of many that we hope that you will do over the, you know, years to come.
What is the point of a mural?
I think there are lots of points.
Justify your existence.
Right. So I say often, and I really believe this, that the kind of work that I'm doing is equally as much about the process that we've been talking about as it is the finished product of the mural itself. Because these projects bring people together to really reexamine the things they care about most and then to act on them. And in the case of the mural, it's a visual painting. But we set up the process so that maybe next time they're advocating for something that's going to happen at City Hall.
Muralist Dave Lowenstein, stay with me through the break, okay?
Sure.
When we come back, we're going to hear what inspired Dave to become a muralist in the first place and what that had to do with him reexamining what really mattered. I'm Gina Kaufman, KCUR Central Standard. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're doing a portrait session with artist Dave Lowenstein. He's a fixture in the Lawrence art scene and a part of lots of communities in many different towns through his murals, which he creates with a lot of input, as we've heard. Dave, how did you become a muralist? I mean, that wasn't the path you were on. You had a change of heart.
Yeah, I guess it was a change of heart. It was a long process, really. I had gone to college in Iowa, Grinnell College, and was making landscape paintings because it was a very new environment for me. I grew up on the north side of Chicago, and I really loved that. Ended up going to grad school for a while.
Loved the new environment of Iowa after leaving Chicago?
I did. Yeah, it was refreshing, new for somebody like me. It was inviting in a way that the openness was inviting in a way that I had never experienced before. And so I found myself...
The physical openness?
Yeah, the physical openness. So I found myself, you know, creating this excuse of making landscape paintings to pull me out there, which was wonderful. Yeah, but I guess, you know, skipping a few years, when I came to Lawrence to go to grad school, I was still sort of making those kinds of paintings, although they had turned quite a bit darker. They were more about issues having to do with the farm crisis that had been going on in the 80s. And
remind us, and we might even have some listeners who weren't alive then, about the farming crisis.
Yeah. So, you know, due to lots of factors, corporate buy-up of small farms and farm prices, many, many century farmers across the Midwest were losing their farms, foreclosing, actually. And this whole idea of, you know, the sort of American idea of, you know, having a family farm was really put into question. And I think we've seen the results. I mean, many of these farms are gone now. And so there was, you know, there was incredible concern in places like Iowa, where lots of these families were being broken up and trying to figure out what they were going to do next. And I didn't know how to depict that, but I was aware of it. It was present. And I was sort
of... Of course, you were aware of it because mm-hmm. you were paying attention to news and so forth. But also being in Iowa as a student, I mean, theoretically kind of protected by the confines of the university, not from a farm family yourself. I mean, here you are, this boy from Chicago.
Right.
Impassioned about the farm crisis.
Yeah, well, that's a really good question, because I was really naive and ignorant in many ways about what was happening. We had speakers who'd come to campus. I remember the folk singer Greg Brown played a show at Grinnell and talked quite a bit about this in his songs and in between songs. And I really loved his concert at the time, I remember, and I felt inspired by him in a way to go and look more deeply at what was happening.
Yeah, so take us forward in this mm-hmm. story. Like, your paintings have become darker because you've been, like, awakened to the struggles of farmers during the farm crisis of the 80s. What then?
Yeah, so I was really trying to find meaning in the art that I was making, and there are a few places in between here. I had spent a short time in Mexico just visiting with a friend and had seen many murals there and was sort of overwhelmed by their presence. Immediately after that, though, I went and I was an apprentice on a small organic farm in upstate New York. And the reason was I wanted to find out more. I felt like I needed some knowledge if I was going to really continue to make this kind of art. When I was there, I experienced many things. One of them that I remember most distinctly is one of the farmers saying about producing this organic produce, if we can't sell it to working class people, then what are we doing? And I really took that to heart when I came to Lawrence and was making my art and thinking about, well, who really sees these paintings? What happens to them after they're out of the studio? You know, if you're lucky, they go into a gallery. If you're lucky, you're somebody who has the money can purchase them. But in the end, it just wasn't enough for me. And I started looking for another way to be an artist where my work would speak to folks who didn't go to art galleries and didn't have the money to purchase paintings.
How did murals become part of your thinking on that?
Yeah. Well, there are a couple different ways. One was this seeing these things in Mexico City when I was there, and that was sort of in the back of my mind. Another was this very crazy synchronous experience that I had at the KU Public Library. I was sort of at my wit's end about what I was doing as an artist, and I was looking through books on public art in the library, and I came across this book. Title is Toward a People's Art, the Community Mural Movement. And I was like, wow, this is something.
Who is the author?
It was John Weber and Eva Cockcroft.
Just curious.
Yeah, two muralists in their own right. And the cover looked really interesting. It had a mural that was obviously done by a group of people. So I started flipping through the book, looking at the pictures, and I was taken by the content of the murals that they were making. They were about people's concerns and aspirations, and they were in all sorts of neighborhoods and interesting places. And then I came upon this one page in the book with some kids painting a mural with a the teacher, and I was overwhelmed by a sense of deja vu looking at this photo in a way that I couldn't explain. I finally looked at the caption, and it said, "Children and Ruth Felton, Miller School Mural, 1975, Evanston, Illinois." And I instantly knew, oh my God, I was in fourth grade, 1975. I went to Miller School, and I'm in the photo in this book.
Whoa!
Yeah. So I saw it as a sign, I guess. I mean, it was one of many of the things that...
Like, not only does a book fall at your feet, but yeah. The book falls in your feet and you're in it.
Right. Strange.
But, okay. Like, help me understand. You saw it as a sign, but can you flesh that out a little bit?
Yeah. So a bunch of different things happened, and it took a period of time. But, you know, I was inspired then to look more deeply at the book and read the whole book and then contact the author, John Weber, especially, who's now a friend and a mentor of mine.
Because clearly the universe has told you to do this.
I guess, yeah. So that was happening. I was still in grad school trying to figure out what I was doing. And a new bar opened in Lawrence called Quinton's. I don't know if anybody's ever been there, but it's on Massachusetts Street. And they wanted a mural for their beer garden. And a friend of mine had told me this. And I was like, oh, God, I guess I have to do this, right? So I went over there and I said, I will try to do this. And they said, well, we'll buy you lunch every day, you know.
So did you stay in the MFA program?
Right. So I started working on that mural project, and I had this moment, I guess, a divide in the road where I thought, I can finish off my MFA. I was doing fine. But if I do...
Or I can trade painting for lunch?
Yeah, I can trade painting for lunch. I thought, you know, if I finished my MFA that I'd be compelled to look for a teaching job. And I didn't know where that was going to take me. Or I could follow this new path, which was very unsure, but it's where my heart was. And I made that choice.
So you'd never done this before. Just the skill of applying paint to a completely vertical surface that is not canvas and, I don't know, is surrounded by people and not often a studio. What was that like?
It was fantastic. It was so much fun, because all of a sudden, you know, you're not just surrounded by other grad students and professors, but you got people walking by, eating lunch, people in the alley, all of them, you know, potential partners or critics. The conversations were amazing. The painting was somehow, I felt liberated on such a large surface. You know, maybe I'm not as good with the small details, so working on such a large canvas was in some ways easier. It was also really fulfilling to see your work in a place that it was supposed to be painted for. You know, all these other things that I'd made, who knows where they were going to end up.
Well, it's interesting to me that not being good at details would make a large surface more forgiving. I would think that would just amplify the details that aren't working.
I guess that could be true. I mean, what happened with my, you know, sort of creation of murals and my aesthetic is that I developed a way of designing murals that sort of fit my own talents. And, you know, that came through many years. It's continuing now. But it played on the fact that maybe I wasn't as good as the small details and followed people like Aaron Douglas, who we mentioned.
You mentioned earlier being from Chicago, and I understand that you're also from a family of artists.
I guess so. You know, we never really saw ourselves that way. We didn't talk about it that way. But my grandfather on my mom's side retired early because he had health problems and became a sculptor who was quite serious, had his own studio near Monterey in California in the late 60s. We have many of his works in the family. And I remember sort of toying around with his stuff as a small kid. And my dad was a set designer for PBS in Chicago for his whole career, creating backdrops for teleplays and ballets and talk shows. And, of course, I was around these huge paintings mostly as a kid and, you know, even dabbled a little when I would go to work with him.
Paintings that were meant for people to kind of like sit in front of or walk back and forth, interact with, just be among.
Yeah. I mean, some of them were quite elaborate, like for ballets that were staged, you know, Frankie and Johnny, for plays that Steppenwolf Theater put on TV and so on. Really fascinating things.
But how cool for a kid to grow up among this, like, giant art, like, in a PBS set. You were living my dream.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know it at the time, right? You're a kid. You don't know what normal is or what, you know, something cool is. But in retrospect, it was amazing. And I can recall seeing how they were made and painted, which was probably really instructive later on.
What kind of kid were you?
I'd say I was extremely shy, but observant. Somebody who kept to himself mostly and had to find ways of being in public where I felt like I was occupied in order to interact with the outside world.
Like what?
Yeah, so when I was much younger, grew up across the street from our elementary school, and always had a fascination with baseball for one reason or another. I think family and friends watched the Cubs, who were Northsiders. So I would go across to the elementary school and throw a ball against the wall, you know, pretending that I was somebody, some player on the team. But that eventually turned into me practicing pitching. That way I would be in control, right?
And maybe a pitcher someday.
And maybe a pitcher someday, which I became. Yeah, doing so much of that tossing.
Wait, what do you mean? You became a pitcher?
Yeah, so doing so much of that tossing the ball against the wall and eventually playing this game we called fast pitch with just a hitter and a pitcher, I got sort of good. And I ended up really focusing on baseball until I went to college. But as you were saying, you know, this was, or as I was saying, this was a way for me to be in public, like in the middle of something, but occupied and feeling a sense of self-confidence.
There is always a wall in everything, too. I mean, you've become a muralist and you grew up throwing balls at the wall and you grew up among set design, which, you know, so kind of walling in these.
Right. Well, what's funny is the wall that I was throwing against, the other side of it was the basement cafeteria where we painted that mural when I was in fourth grade at Miller School that I found in the book.
But you know what's interesting is that a lot of other shy kids. I was also a shy kid, and I think I just chose to be by myself a lot of the time. I didn't really worry about finding a way to be in public. I just kind of didn't do that.
Yeah. I mean, there are different things that led to me sort of coming out in that way. To talk once more about Miller School, I remember when I was going into fifth grade, Miller School was closed. Downsized or whatever. And I remember going to meetings with my mom to fight to keep it open and being absolutely astounded when, even though all these people had protested to keep it open, they closed it. Sort of my first moment of radicalization. There were other moments, like in college, where I first came to understand the importance of getting out on the street and actually fighting for an issue. And I had this one moment actually when I was at Grinnell where a speaker had come to the college to talk about a homeless shelter in Des Moines and at the end had asked everyone in the crowd, hundreds of people, if you're going to go help, stand up. And I was petrified because I thought, oh my God, I don't know if I can do anything. I certainly can't. But all these people stood up. And a few days later, a friend and I, Kelly, who had been there, got up the courage to call this shelter because they were going to be closed down, actually, by the city. And we said, well, we know all these students have come to help, and we just want to know if there's anything else we can do. And the woman who ran the place, Patty McDonald, said, I don't know what you're talking about. Nobody from Grinnell has called or come here.
None of those people who stood up.
Right. And so I couldn't process that at the time. I didn't understand. I mean, people did it because they felt pressured. People couldn't go because they didn't have time. But I recognized in that moment, and Kelly did too, that since we had made the call, it was our responsibility to do this. And so that drew me out as well.
Responsibility did.
I think so. I mean, I had, you know, gotten up the courage to make the phone call. And so there was obviously an intent to do something. And then when I realized, like, there wasn't anybody else, I felt like, oh my gosh, yeah, I'm going to have to get over this fear of public speaking really fast.
I want to go back to the kid throwing a baseball against a wall out in Chicago. I mean, you mentioned being an observant kid in addition to a shy kid, and I wonder what you saw when you were out there. Did you see anything other than the wall and what you were doing there? Did you see who was going by, what was happening? Any scenes really stand out?
Oh my gosh. So this would have been in the late 1970s. And there were usually other people around. There were people playing basketball, other people playing fast pitch, and kids coming in and out of school. And I think what I was observing was how to be social in some ways. So I'm trying to think if there are any particular scenes. I don't know. I think I was just happy to have something I was doing that gave me a purpose while other people could come and go around me. And that's something that carried on. You know, I was thinking about this when we were talking earlier, when I moved to Iowa and I started painting these landscapes out in the countryside. It was the same kind of thing. You know, instead of going up to a farmer's house or, you know, talking to somebody straight on, I would be this painter and maybe somebody would come and say hi to me.
Aww. That's in a way kind of sad, but also it's very unobtrusive and kind of gracious.
It was coping too.
You know, okay, going back to your childhood a little more, maybe this is not worth talking about, but mm-hmm. I just don't know. Your parents got divorced?
Yeah, my parents got divorced, I think, after I was in college. Still close to both of them. One great story, about the artist in the family is that after my folks got divorced, my mom had a real second act. She had, you know, raised my brother and I, had stopped working to do that for many years. But after they split up, she thought deeply about who she wanted to be and hadn't become yet, and thought about her dad, my grandfather, the sculptor. And decided she wanted to try to make some art herself, and ended up taking ceramics classes first in Evanston, where we were, and then later she moved to Lawrence and worked in the same studio with me for many years and became a really prolific potter. So it was pretty cool to see that.
And you worked together in the same studio?
Yeah, for many years.
Okay, maybe I'm going out on a limb here, and you can just tell me that I'm crazy if you like. But so much of what you do as a muralist is not entirely about the art. It's about taking these communities where something has happened and bringing people back together is like with a story that kind of can inspire them and make them a happy family again. You know what I mean? And I wonder if that bringing people together part of it, I mean, especially for a shy kid, like, your family has just been through this rupture. I don't know. Maybe I'm being ridiculous.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it connects directly like that, but I see where you're going. I can tell you that I can tell you that with the projects, the families that we bring together that I'm invited to be a part of are not always happy. We argue a lot on the projects, which is good, but I think it's always pointed in a really great direction because we're trying to figure out how to represent ourselves, how to tell our own stories. And I've been embraced now by so many new families that there is something to what you're saying about sort of recreating and rebuilding those relationships.
In theory, your murals don't just tell stories, but they also change them.
Yeah, I guess so. I think one thing that happens that I'm really a fan of and really was inspired by, you know, my mentors with this. There's a great muralist named Judy Baca, whose most well-known project is the Great Mural Wall of Los Angeles. And she calls it a place of memory, you know, creating places of memory. And I think that's a really important thing to think about when we look at our visual landscape in our communities and how often we're sort of bombarded with advertisements and with slogans, sloganeering, but we rarely see ourselves and our own stories reflected, especially, you know, regular everyday folks. And by creating
like ourselves or some other person who is a regular person.
Yeah. And so by giving space, prominent space to our own stories, I think we can change the way we see ourselves as a community. And one of the wonderful things that happens with the murals is that the sites themselves become places where people tell new stories and use the murals as a reference.
Can you give an example of that?
Yeah. So let me think of a good one. Well, there's a mural. Let's see. Yeah, there's a mural in Lawrence called Seeds that's painted on the old co-op grocery store. It's now a liquor store. And it was also going to be destroyed at one point, but people came together to save it. And so it's been there now about 20 years. And I've had many conversations with folks who talk about their own childhood being a part of that mural and remembering it as the first moment where they stood up for something when it was going to be taken down. Very cool.
Dave Lowenstein, we're going to be right back to your story, okay?
Sure.
We'll talk with Dave Lowenstein when we get back about restoring murals he created 25 years ago and about becoming a father. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and I'm talking with artist Dave Lowenstein. He lives in Lawrence now, but he comes from Chicago, and it was in Iowa in college that he became enamored with the countryside and with being political in his art. We're talking to him now about what it's like to go back to towns where he created a mural to restore them. Dave, hello again.
Hi.
So what is that like? What creates that need, first of all?
Well, I mean, like your own house, if you own your house, you have to repaint it every 10 or 20 years, right? If you want it to be in good shape, and murals are no different. I mean, I'm not painting frescoes, which could last hundreds of years. These are murals painted with acrylic paint, you know, out in the weather.
So when you go back to a town that you haven't been to in, what, like 20, 25 years, what is that like? Have you usually seen the art again in that time that's passed, or is this the first return?
Yeah, so this is something that's occupying more of my time now because I started doing this, like you said, about 25 years ago. And there are communities whose murals I worked on who really still love them, and they need a little work. They're not usually in need of work because of vandalism or anything, just time. And so I'm invited back to do a restoration, and it's wonderful. It's sort of like going back to your elementary school when you're a kid, or as an adult, and everything's bigger or smaller. Or I guess it's smaller when you go back, right?
Yeah. But
you know, all the memories of the time flood back, and you're reintroduced to people that you worked with who have, in many cases, grown up and had their own families, and you find out how things have changed in the community. And I found it to be actually really like a homecoming in many senses to do these things again. And I'm so grateful to the folks who want these things to continue.
Is there a community that changed in a way that really surprised you?
Yeah, good question. So a few years ago, restored a mural in Hutchinson, a really big mural that's sort of about the night sky and constellations that we designed ourselves instead of the ones that exist there. And going back, the mural looked really good. The town, though, had lost a lot of businesses and a lot of people, and it felt like it was in a precarious place. And I wondered then, redoing this mural, how the mural fit in with that new version of the town. Because at the time when I was there, my recollection was it was this vibrant celebration of the aspirations of Hutchinson and the stars and so on. Looking at it a second time, I was wondering if it was referencing something that was, that had passed, perhaps.
Did that make you sad?
It did. It did in some ways. And, you know, I wondered how other people saw the mural as well. You know, folks who had known it all those years, but also younger folks who came to know it as they grew up. And I think that's an interesting thing with architecture, with sculpture, with murals that are in the public realm, that their meanings can change depending on the time and circumstances.
So, you know, so many of your murals are in rural places or small towns. And I think when you talk about what inspired you, looking at this book of murals or like the murals in Chicago, I mean, people think of these as city art in a way. And that is, I feel like you've turned that on its head a little bit.
I guess so. I mean, I can say that there are murals everywhere. My good friend Laura Jost and I wrote a book about the murals of Kansas about 10 years ago. And so we went to every little town that had a mural in the state. And they really are everywhere and made by all sorts of people. So I don't think that's entirely true. We think of it as an urban phenomenon
now. We think of it that way, yeah.
But it's not really the case. And some of the smaller communities, sort of getting back to the Hutchinson example, folks are painting murals sort of to replace what was a more active downtown, trying to find a new way to make themselves relevant or attractive to visitors, as we were talking about with Joplin a long time ago. And that's an interesting notion to do that. There are also, of course, communities like Kansas City and others who are using muralists to invigorate a maybe working class or industrial part of town that they want to turn into a hip new neighborhood.
So as I have alluded to, you are going to become a father like kind of any day, any minute.
Yeah, we talked to him this morning, soon to be born son, and said, you just have to wait till the interview's over. And then, yeah.
Okay, so you can't know right now how this is going to change you, but has it already changed how you think about the things that have meant a lot to you, the things that we're discussing? Like, do you think about those things differently as you imagine bringing another person into the world?
In every way, I guess. I mean, they're big ways. Like, for many years, I saw myself as sort of an itinerant artist who could live anywhere, maybe, and move, you know, at any moment. And now I know we're gonna stay. Connie, myself, and our son will stay in Lawrence for a while at least. And that's a really reassuring and wonderful thing to know.
That Kansas is just home for a while.
Yeah, for sure. And sort of looking at it in a new way, looking at it through the potential of his eyes, I guess, and wondering what experiences you want to share and all those kinds of things. Yeah.
You come from this family of artists. I mean, I don't expect you to be some like backstage dad or something, but is it important to you to share art with this kid?
Well, my partner, Connie, as well, is an artist and an activist, and I think he will experience lots of both of those things. And what he chooses to do, of course, is entirely up to him.
So thinking of Kansas as your home and your family's home now, you know, you have these roots in Chicago, and I'm curious what Kansas means to you as a place. I mean, is there something about the spirit or the history that has really inspired you? Because so much of your art has been really grounded in Kansas.
Yeah, we didn't talk about, I do a lot of other kinds of art, and a lot of it's more politically charged and has to do with Kansas and our current challenges. I think one thing that I've found, especially in recent years, is with the incredible challenges we're having in the state and nationally, there are a lot of folks who say, you know, I'm going to get out. Now's the time to get out of Kansas, maybe get out of the U.S. And I feel slightly differently. Although it may be difficult, I feel like I'm a Kansan now, and it's my responsibility to stay and do what I can.
Well, Dave Lowenstein, this has been great. Thank you so much for talking with me today and for taking the risk of driving to Kansas City when your son could arrive any minute.
Thank you, Gina.
Our time is up, but this has been a portrait session with Dave Lowenstein. That means early next week we'll have this interview online with photographic portraits by the talented Paul Andrews. You can get all of it at kcur.org/centralstandard. And you can also hear past shows like yesterday's conversation about the legacy of Harry Truman and the atomic bomb. We spoke with Pulitzer Prize winning Kansas City native Richard Rhodes, so be sure and check that out. We also had a moral philosopher. It was a pretty crazy conversation. kcur.org/centralstandard. It's the weekend, but you can stay in touch with us on Twitter. We're @kcurcst. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Danielle Hogarty. Linda Scher runs the board for us every day. Our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs, and our portrait session partner is Paul Andrews. I'm Gina Kaufman. Have a great weekend. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.